to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West. Alan Morris Jones and Russell Rowland are contemporary authors with novels deeply entrenched in the soil and soul of rural Montana. The authors join us in the studio to talk about their newest novels, both murder mysteries set on the agricultural backgrounds of this beautiful state.
Today we're going to talk about literature in the West, and to begin the show, I think let's have a little narrative. I'd ask each of you guys to read a section of your book to give us a little color about the book, and you could tell us a little bit about that, too.
Sounds like a great plan. Welcome to the studio, guys.
Thanks for having us. You bet.
Russell, do you want to start?
Sure. So, yeah, this is my latest novel called Arbuckle, which is the prequel to my first novel, In Open Spaces. It's told from the point of view of the two main characters, Catherine Boland and George Arbuckle, who... That was the name of my great-grandparents, so it's sort of loosely based on them. And I'm just going to read the opening, which is in her point of view. I have never been a shy girl. From as far back as I can remember, my father told me, "Catherine, don't you be afraid to speak your mind," and I wasn't. My father was afraid I would turn out like my mother. Not that he didn't adore her, but he never got used to the way she went through life sideways, worrying that the worst was going to happen. He wanted better for me. He wanted me to be my own person. That's what I was thinking as I stood in the lobby of the Deadwood Bank. I couldn't stop staring at the manager's Adam's apple. The marble in his throat jumped with every word he spoke to the point that I almost lost track of what he was saying, but I caught the gist of it, and I cut him off. "You are making a mistake, sir." His mouth curled into a smirk. "Pardon me? You heard me. You're making a mistake." "Well..." The bank manager raised his brow, making no effort to hide his amusement. "You do realize, Miss Boland, that a woman of your..." He paused, fingering the knob in his neck as if it needed to be adjusted. "Age?" I finished. I identified a faint whiff of something unpleasant, something sour, cabbage maybe, and it made me that much firmer in my conviction. "Sir, for one thing, I'm not nearly as old as I appear, and for another, the fact that you would think that's important, well, it just makes me that much less interested in working for you." The man puffed air through his nose. "That's interesting, Miss Boland, because I see you don't have a wedding ring either. Considering how few women there are around here, it says a lot about you that you haven't found a husband or a job."
I had forgot what a comic voice that is. And the banker is a fun character throughout the novel.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So,
okay, we'll get back to questions about that. But Alan, how about your book? Tell us a little bit about that and read a passage for us.
So this also is from my most recent novel. This is from A Bloom of Bones. Just to set it up briefly, it's a... It's a crime novel with a literary bent to it, I think. And the piece I'm going to read is set in the 1970s. It's a flashback. I open the novel with the crime itself, and then the rest of the novel in some ways catches up to the opening scene. I said, "That big bullet went right on through, didn't it?" It was too cold to snow, but still it was snowing, a thin sheet of gauze twisting around the porch light. Buddy kicked through frozen marbles of blood, scattered at them, swept them aside with his boot. He knelt and rose, hoisting the body across one shoulder. Voice muffled by a wool scarf, he said, "Leaking?" "What? Is he leaking anywhere?" "I don't see it." "All right, then. That big bullet went plumb through, didn't it? Will you quit with the questions, just for once?" A gentleman, Buddy rarely cussed, seldom rebuked, never raised his voice. I stood abashed, one breath from tears. He inhaled hard through his nose, shifted the body on his shoulders. "Let's just get this done." He set off toward the county road, walking fast. I ran to catch up. To the east, it was 50 miles of dirt until you hit the two saloons and five churches of Jordan. To the west, nothing but the mussel shell. At 2 in the morning and barring high school kids off on a jacklighting drunk, there'd be no traffic. We had the road to ourselves. I huffed along beside him. You ain't taking the truck? You want Pete's blood all over my truck bed? No, I guess that's right. He glanced down. You can get on home if you want. No use for us both. I want to help. All right, then. Where are we taking them? I was thinking Cherry Creek. All them little eroded holes. Oh, sure. Our breath bloomed blue around us. Up on the road, he said, we don't want to leave no tracks. Careful just to step in the ruts. All right. Just step where I step. Okay. He shifted the body. It sure turned cold on us, didn't it?
Wow. Thank you for sharing, both of you. That is quite an isolated environment. It seems like actually both of your books are set in these more rural areas. How does environment really affect the narrative?
Well, yeah, I've always been kind of fascinated by that aspect of Montana's history, you know, how people responded to living in an isolated area. And I think it's a big part of why we have such a high suicide rate here. So one of the things I've always really thought a lot about is the fact that the people that had problems back in the homesteading days particularly didn't have anybody to talk to except their family, and that was usually the people that were causing their problems. So it was a complicated and sort of, confining issue that they didn't have the ability to reach out to people. They didn't have phones. And I try to explore that a lot in my fiction, and it was a big part of this book.
So for A Bloom of Bones, the central conceit of the novel is that there was a body buried in the Missouri Breaks that 30 years after a crime occurred, the body eroded out of the hillside, kind of triggering the narrative. So the isolation in that country, I think, is central to the novel insofar as somebody got away with the crime for 30 years. And if you've spent any time in that country, you know how in fact isolated it is. I have a connection to that country, to the Missouri Breaks, and we tell people that our place is 50 miles from a gallon of milk, which is pretty true. And if you want to run to the store, you have to go 50 miles on gravel. Along with that, you're also 50 miles from law enforcement, from the nearest sheriff or nearest deputy. And so if you wanted to get away with a horrendous crime, you know, this is the place to do it.
That's interesting when you talk about law, because both of your books have extreme violence, or there's a pivotal point of extreme violence. Is that like crime novel? Is that a turning point of all narrative? Or does it have a sort of Western feel to it?
Well, I don't think it has to be, but in my case, one of the things I really wanted to explore in this book was how rape was viewed and handled in the back in the late 19th century. And, I haven't seen a lot of literature address that issue. So Catherine, the main character, gets raped. And the main thing I wanted to explore with that was, not only how the community responds, because it was a very puritanical attitude toward all that stuff back then. People didn't like to talk about it. So when she decides to go public with this, with the fact that she's been raped, there's the typical attitude of people shunning her and not wanting to talk to her. But I mainly wanted to explore how it affected her marriage and how difficult it was for George to deal with the fact that she decided to go public.
Well, there's also a lynching, Russell.
Yes, that's true, too. Yep, there's lynching. There's vigilante justice.
And interestingly, they also don't talk about that.
Right, that's true.
that it happened, and it's really based on Montana history, but people knew about it, but nobody was naming names.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. That was part of another thing that I wanted to explore with this. Yeah, there was a lot of vigilante justice going on in that part of the state at that time. So
sounds like there was a lot of research that went into understanding this time period and how that puritanical, experience was unfolding for these not necessarily characters, but subjects at the time to inform your characters.
Yeah, well, I've been writing about that part of the state a lot for most of my career. So there has been a lot of research behind it for sure, yeah.
And Alan, up on the Missouri Breaks, it's very isolated area. And the violence in your story happens really early, and then it's a flashback when the body's discovered. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I describe this book to, when I'm talking about the book to friends or when I'm reading, I describe it as a crime novel. And it opens with the crime. I'm always a little grateful when people get past the first 10 pages of the book to read further. It's not an especially violent book, but there is that opening scene. And, of course, it's all downhill from there. The challenge I gave myself with this book was to work within genre, to write a crime novel, but then to flip it around, to subvert it. So it's a crime novel. It's ostensibly something of a mystery, but in the opening pages, we have a pretty good idea of who did it and what happened. As a writer, how do you work with that? That's kind of a challenge.
I think of both these books as sort of classical Westerns in the fact that neither of your characters are real heroes. They're sort of anti-heroes. And I wonder, again, is that a theme of sort of Montana literature, the scarred individual?
Yeah, I suppose it is, in part. Part of the reason that turned out that way in this book for me was because I always try to turn the stereotypes on their head a little bit. And so George ends up being part of this lynching that you mentioned, and he's not there by choice. He's been dragged into it. And he even realizes halfway through the whole thing that he doesn't have a gun, so he's kind of wondering what the hell he's doing there. Yeah, he ends up being sort of heroic in the eyes of some of the other members of this posse, which is also confusing and really unwanted from him. So, yeah, I think you're right that there's an interesting twist sometimes in Montana literature where the person who is least likely and least desiring some kind of heroic title ends up in that role for some reason. So,
and Alan, you've got obviously an anti-hero in your novel. How much did that play a role in crafting this book?
I'm not sure that while I was crafting the book that I was thinking in terms of hero or anti-hero. I was trying to create a three-dimensional character. When you try to create as realistic a person as possible, there are elements of the anti-hero that come through. We're all flawed individuals, So to create a real hero without qualification is to kind of be a little lazy as a writer, I think, in some ways. I'd be interested in Russell's thoughts on this as well. The idea of the anti-hero as being kind of central to Western literature, it didn't start out that way. I mean, I agree with you guys that that's a thing. That's an element of contemporary literature. But you look at the history of literature in the West, and our heroes used to be very one-dimensional. You start out, it's the kind of the John Wayne archetype, if you will. So there's the white hat and the black hat. The good guy rides into town and solves everybody's problems. So it occurs to me that maybe the trend toward the anti-hero is a reaction against that foundation or playing a riff off of it in some ways. I know Russell has given some thought to this as well.
Yeah. I think Owen Wister's to blame for the original template, but it's always been fascinating to me that it started to turn when Willa Cather became big. And, she was the first writer from the West to win any major literary prize. And I think she was the one that first started to write about the West in a real way. It was she wrote about alcoholism and domestic violence, and her characters were real.
That idea of writing about the West in a real way, how are women portrayed in your books, and how much is that very true to life for that time period?
Well, that was definitely a challenge with this book. I wanted to have Catherine be someone who is not as stoic as women are mostly portrayed in that time period. You know, I think it's easy to fall into this idea that everyone was the same, you know, they all spoke in a certain way and all that. So I wanted her to be more vocal about her feelings and about her reaction to things. And that was really hard to do without, you know, sort of resorting to contemporary vernacular. So that was a challenge.
Alan, in your book, I'm thinking of the two women, a very strong New York-based editor character, mm-hmm. and then the mother, who I wanted to do more or respond more, and she doesn't. Can you talk about those two characters?
So to address the New York agent character, I found it helpful as a writer in revealing the character of a place or an environment if you can introduce some contrast. So when we bring a New York or Easterner character into the West and see the West through their eyes, it provides a helpful foil, a helpful entree into the subject. So we see Montana in two different ways. We see it from a hero or anti-hero, and we see it from this character of Chloe, who's coming in from New York. The character of Chloe, the strong New York woman, was meant to be in some ways a foil. Hopefully a character. She has her own conflicts and her own issues to resolve. She is a substantial part of the book, but introducing her also allowed us to see Montana in a particular way. The mother character, she was in a, as the flashback opens, she was in a really difficult spot. So she's in, it's the 1970s. She's a recent widow. There's not a lot of places for her to go. One of the catalysts for the story is that she ends up working as a housemaid in the breaks outside of Jordan. And that was one of the few opportunities that she had. So in some ways, her lack of options is central to the story. Mm-hmm. She had to be in that position in order for the story to take place.
I love the idea of telling the story through their eyes. It's so important to set those characters in and have this kind of narrative unfold. And Russell, you use a lot of dialogue, obviously both of you do, to get these storylines across. And sounds like that it gets a little bit of play in fiction, but to retain the historical nature of the time period is important too.
It strikes me to mention these two books are alike insofar as there are two different narrative voices. So we have part of the book, each book that's written in first person. So the character is telling the story. And then we have a substantial part of the book that's written in third person. And the two voices are flip-flopped between the two books. So I chose to write most of the story in first person from the male point of view. Then the third person was from the female point of view, limited third. Russell did the opposite. Russell did first person from the female point of view, from Catherine's point of view, and then limited third from George.
I wanted to get in touch with my inner female. So.
And they're both placed in the most isolated parts of Montana.
That's true.
That's another common theme. Yeah.
What's the most difficult form to write in? Do you find third person or first person a little bit more challenging?
I've always liked first person better. I think it gives you a more immediacy and more, you just get into the character's head more. That's what I've always liked about it.
I'm not sure I have a preference. It's all equally difficult.
So I do have a question. I'm wondering, both of you are not only prolific writers, but you know so many of the writers in Montana. I'm wondering, is there a vernacular for Montana or the West in terms of contemporary literature?
I don't think there is. I think there was. I was talking to Richard Wheeler recently, who's written 80 novels, most of them Westerns, and he had an interesting observation. He said, Westerns are really Southern literature. And you kind of see that especially in the old Western movies, there's the drawl, you know. And so I think at one point there was the speech patterns in the West were influenced by the South. But, you know, Montana has this really attracted writers from all over the place. And the strength of the program in Missoula and the Livingston community have really drawn people from all over the place. So I think it's evolved to the point where people here just write about whatever they're interested in. So there's not really a common vernacular anymore.
I agree with that. I think it's to the credit of our community that there's such a diversity of voices. Everyone has their own particular way of writing about this particular place and these particular people.
It's hard to even identify Montana books anymore because they're, you know, how do you determine that? Is it just because somebody lives here, or is it just because they're writing about Montana? I mean, there's a lot of categories now.
And Montana seems to be really attracting a lot of creative people because it is a place that is so inspirational just to be around. And also, it's still pretty affordable to make a go here as a creative person.
So if there isn't a particular vernacular, is there a theme that is very popular in terms of Montana literature?
You know, you can probably find something. It would probably be a stretch, you know, for my money. We talked about this, Corby, at a social event not long ago, but Montana, the West in general, has been described as the geography of hope. That's almost a trite phrase at this point. But it occurs to me that maybe if people came here aspiring toward a certain hope, if Montana is the place where you come when you aspire or when you're driven here or some other circumstances, it's a place you come to. If things don't work out, then maybe it's thwarted hope or something of that sort. So it's aspirations, but then complications. I feel like I'm reaching a little bit by going that direction. So,
you know what it reminds me of is Will James and characters like that who came here to reinvent themselves, or who could reinvent themselves. Yes. You can be whomever you want to be here in the Wild West.
There was a lot of that, and I think it ended up being a bigger challenge for a lot of those people than they expected because of the isolation and the fact that you're all sort of expected to be self-sufficient. That's probably one of the themes that does emerge, is that everyone is trying to sort of contend with this idea that they need to be self-sufficient and self-contained.
Yeah.
Interesting. It kind of reminds me too, or once makes me want to ask the question about publishing. Russell, I think you have an interesting storyline on how this book got published, but I think you have interesting storylines on how all your books got out into the world. And is it the idea of the self-sufficient writer, or it just seems like it's quite a challenge to get a book into
the
world.
It is a challenge. And, you know, I actually owe a lot to Alan because he published the two books previous to this one. And the only reason he didn't publish this one is because he's not doing fiction anymore with his press. But, I decided to do this one myself. And fortunately, I have enough of a following now that I was able to do a Kickstarter campaign and raise the money to do that. I did sell my next one to another publisher, so I'm kind of relieved to not have to do it again. It was a lot more work than I expected.
Alan, tell us a little bit about your publishing career.
I've kind of been all over the place. As we all know, it's difficult to make a living as a writer, so you end up spinning a lot of plates. You know, you run from one thing to the other, trying to keep them all going. And in my case, I started out in magazine publishing. I was editor of Big Sky Journal for some years in the 90s. My first book was A Treatise on the Ethics of Hunting. I went freelance for a while when my first novel was published. Last Year's River was published well through Houghton Mifflin. From there, I ended up going into the editorial side of book publishing. So I worked for a mid-sized book publisher named Globe Pequot Press. They also owned Lions Press, which is a little bit of a better known imprint. Did that for a while, and then ended up opening my own small press called Bangtail Press. And we've been doing that. It's my wife describes it as a garage band. we've been doing that for 11 or 12 years now, and have published, you know, close to 20 books. And that's been a gas, because I not only get to edit and publish writers whom I admire, I get to design their books as well, which is a lot of fun. I taught myself how to be a graphic designer, which is just a ball. I really enjoy that aspect of it.
He's good at it, too. He did the cover for this book, too.
And I know that both of you guys are familiar with Aaron Parrott and his Territorial Press in Helena. And I think I love his writing as much as I love his books, beauty of the book. So that must be a great project to have a hand in actually how the book looks.
Yes. Aaron's been a great influence on both of us. And now he's publishing Alan's next poetry collection, including some woodcuts from Seth Roby, who's a partner of his. But yeah, Aaron and I also do a podcast called Breakfast in Montana, where we talk about Montana books. So he's been a great friend.
He's a pillar of the Montana literary community, I think you'd have to say at this point. And he plays a mean fiddle as well.
That's true. Yeah.
Speaking of, what writers influence you both and why?
Well, Willa Cather, like I mentioned before, I think when I found her, I was really blown away by how honest she was about the West. And then another big influence has been Faulkner, who I think just broke every single rule in the book and always, most of the time, did it successfully. I mean, he's got a few duds there, but...
It's a long list, but I would start with Faulkner as well, I would imagine. When I was in high school, I read The Bear, Faulkner's novella. Mm. That was one of those, you know, seminal moments as a writer. You read something and it's the lights come on a little bit. Cormac McCarthy was another influence for me. That was a moment in college. Annie Proulx has been a big influence. Every good writer you read, you know, you can take something away from their work. They do something good that you...
So I would ask, what are you reading now? What is on your book stand, your nightstand next to your bed? So give our listener something to look forward to or go check out.
I've been reading and writing a lot of poetry lately, so I've been preoccupied with certain poets. Ted Kooser just came out with a new and selected book of poetry. He's fantastic. I really admire his stuff. Russell?
Well, I just have to put in a pitch for Alan's book. I mean, Bloom of Bones was one of the best Montana novels I've read in a long time. And I'm always eager to push Louise Erdrich. I think she's the best living writer in America right now, in my view. So,
gentlemen, thank you so much. I would let our listeners know that Bloom of Bones and Arbuckle are both in bookstores all across Montana. So if you want a good story, check out Alan Jones and Russell Rowland.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you both for being here.
You've been listening to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains, produced by Anna Page, Corby Skinner, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Naumann. Hear this program anytime online at ypradio.org.